or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I think that even in an era in which we get so much content on the internet, librarians and libraries really remain crucial. You know, I do a semi-regular feature on the show. It's called What's It Really Like to Be a Whatever? And this morning, what's it really like to be a librarian today and tomorrow? With me is the acting deputy director for the Berkeley Public Library, Sarah Denton. Sarah, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So what might surprise me about being a librarian?
Well, something that we get a lot from people who are interested in what we do is comments about just how much time we must have to read and how much reading we must do. And the fact of the matter is I don't know any librarian who has enough time to read.
Wow.
Certainly at work, we don't have time to read. We're either providing service to members of the public or we're doing outreach to underserved communities or we are working with local organizations to see what their needs are or we're attending city council meetings.
Why would you attend a city council meeting?
Well, a couple of different reasons. One, to advocate for ourselves because many of us get our funding out of general funds, so we need to make sure that the folks who make the decisions about general funds understand how vital we are. But also, we really need to know what's happening in our communities because what happens there matters to the people who use our services. And so we need to know what people are talking about, what people are excited about, and what people are angry about so that we know that we have the resources that they're going to need to find more information.
Right. You might hold an event about some controversial topic.
Absolutely,
in Berkeley. Well, you talk about the resources. You know, conventional wisdom is that with so much content available electronically, mm-hmm. book length, article length, video length, mm-hmm. that expensive real estate called a library, it's maybe not the wisest use of taxpayer funds to have stacks after stacks after stacks of shelves. How do you respond to that?
Well, the first thing is that books still matter. I mean, our circulation is fairly consistent over a number of years. It is true that our e-books are becoming more popular and more of those are checking out. But the point is that people still care about stories and it doesn't matter what kind of container they're in. That said, books as a container are not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, you told me off the air that there's actually studies that show that people, really lots of people, really do want that book. Even though you could have 10 million books in one computer,
yeah.
You know, people want to, and I guess it's deemed it's worth continuing to have the book.
Absolutely, and it's also a recent study that came out from the Pew Institute indicated that, in fact, younger adults, so people between the ages of about 19 and 35, are reading more than the rest of us who are older than those people. So, and that's true in print books and in e-books. They read more of both kinds of books. So we know that reading's going to be around.
Well, in dueling surveys, I just did a review of Generation Z, and they said that ever more young people want their information in very short chunks. 1 and 2 minute YouTube videos are the quintessential example of that. Is there a way in which, do you disagree with that? And if you agree with it, how might the library respond to something like that?
Well, I think I agree to it in part. I mean, if you look at the design of nonfiction books, particularly for kids, but also for teenagers and probably eventually for adults, we're seeing a lot more reliance on images, whether they're pictures or infographics, visual ways of communicating information. So we do see a lot more of that happening, but you still have to learn how to read those things. And you learn that by working with text in conjunction with those things. So I think there's going to be that kind of back and forth.
The stereotype back to what a librarian's life is like, we view you as bookish. You were advocating the book, but you're as bookish. Now, you told me that a librarian has to be a people person.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Well, so much of what we do is actually public service. So it's about a person coming in with a question, and very often the question they ask you is, in fact, not the question that they need an answer to.
Hmm.
So someone comes in and says, where are your books about Julia Child? And and it turns out that actually they want a particular French recipe. So you need to be able to have those kinds of back and forths with people to drill down to what it is exactly that they're looking for. But also, you need to be able to create a welcoming environment in a space. You need to be able to deal with disruptions. As we see social safety nets breaking down, we are becoming one of the few places where people can go and not get hassled if they're not spending money. And that's wonderful and an incredible part of the service that we provide. But it also does cause some tension between folks for whom that is anxiety causing, for lack of a better word.
Give me a concrete example you actually faced.
We had a person come into the library not too long ago who was having some very serious health problems. And because of those health problems, was unable to communicate in a way that any of us could understand. And the person was getting extremely, extremely agitated and disruptive because of the amount of noise and that sort of stuff that we were having. So we have a system that we have in place trying to de-escalate situations. But, you know, we also reach out to Berkeley's Mobile Mental Health and other organizations that can come and help us deal with those issues in a way that's both sensitive but makes the library a place that everybody can use.
What's the best practice for de-escalating a situation like that?
Well, a lot of it is just about staying calm. I think if you come in agitated and aggressive, it can really cause a person who's already frightened to act out even more. So you need to maintain control of the situation, keep your own calm, and
let's
then
role play it.
Yeah.
Let's say I was, you know, I once did go to the main branch of the Berkeley Public Library, and there was a guy exposing himself right there. You don't sound surprised.
Well, I mean, it's not that I'm not surprised. I would hope that sort of illegal activity we tend to like to call the police for.
Okay.
But
let's say I'm yelling. Okay, so let's say I'm yelling and screaming. I have a mental illness or whatever. Walk me through it, and you're the librarian on duty, and you're being your best self, following the procedure. What would you do?
I'd come up to you and I'd say, you know, I understand that you're upset about X, Y, and Z. I really need to ask you to keep your voice down. If you're not able to keep your voice down, you are going to have to leave the library for the day.
And what if he says something? I'm just making it.
He may
well calm down. But what if he says, you know, these stupid overdue fines, I pay my taxes, I hate it. I'm not going to pay that. You're not going to take my library card away.
I understand that, and I'd love to talk to you about that. But we can't do that while you're raising your voice. So if you can bring your voice down, and we can step over here to this public but not completely public place, then I'd be happy to talk you through that, but I really need you to keep your voice down.
Cool. Tell me a little bit about, you said creating a welcoming space. In every workplace, there's a desire to create a welcoming space. What is the, if Sarah Denton had one little, if there is, a secret sauce to creating a welcoming space? I mean, we talked about it being in her home with coffee or whatever, but off the air, but what's one thing that Sarah likes to do to create a welcoming space in a library, which might be applicable to all kind of workplaces?
I think it's acknowledging people when they come into the space. And I'm not talking about the kind of acknowledgement, you know, the sort of, hi, how are you?
The Starbucks.
Canned, right. You know, not the hi, how are you that says, and I'm watching you if you're stealing anything. That's not what you're doing. But something that really makes people feel like you're happy to see them when they come in the door. And we really are. I mean, sometimes when we're behind the desk, people will come to us and say, I'm really sorry to interrupt you. But if I'm on the desk, it's because I'm here to be interrupted, not to do any of the other stuff I may be doing in between.
Okay. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko in my semi-regular segment, What Is It Really Like to Be a What? Whatever. It's what it was like to be a librarian. I'm talking with Sarah Denton. She is the acting deputy director for the Berkeley Public Library. And let's do a different kind of role play.
Okay.
You know, you say that your job is in large measure to help people find the resource they need. And the show's about work. So let's say I'm coming to you and I say, you know, I've been laid off, like, or fired. They say laid off, or it's like fired 3 times now. And, you know, yeah, it's the damn employer and the capitalist system and whatever. But, you know, maybe there's a little bit me too. And I want to read something or get something that maybe I won't get fired so often.
Okay.
If you're the librarian on duty, where do you go from there?
Wow, that sounds like an awful lot. I mean, I've got a couple of things that I'd like you to take a look at, see if they're what you're looking for. If not, I want you to come back and we'll talk through it a little bit more. But the first thing I want you to take a look at are some of these books that we have that have titles along the lines of what to do when you're fired or what to do when you're laid off. We've got 3 or 4 different titles. titles, and those will give you things to look at, questions to ask yourself, questions about information about the current kind of job situation, so you can make some calls about where the issue is. And then once you're done with that, let's see what other questions you have, and we can move forward from there.
Sounds great. I love librarians. I told you off the air, and I said it actually in promoting the show last week. Really, I think just my own values are that if I were single, I'm married, I love my wife, we'll be together forever, but if I were single, the first place I'd go would be a librarians convention. They represent the perfect combination of intelligence and caring.
Well, contrary to many of the stereotypes, we're also really good conversationalists. So.
I believe it. Oh, yeah. Why would you not be? Right. You're as well-read as anybody.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, one of the things that's a little less human but is absolutely critical, especially in this career world that I live in and mm-hmm. this show is about, is databases.
Mm-hmm.
We all tend to think that all the information in the world is available on Google, but it's not.
No.
There are these amazing companies like Gale, G-A-L-E, that put together Reference USA and Riches and all these places that put together these amazingly complicated deep databases that are easily searchable,
mm-hmm.
which of course could not be made available free. They nobody you know. Tell us about the career resources mm-hmm. that exist in databases that anybody with a library card could have, but no individual person could afford.
Yeah, well, and one thing I want to say is that all of these are available remotely with
right.
your library card.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So once you get a card, you don't have to come and see us again. We'd like you to, but you don't have to. We do have Reference USA, which is one of the ones that you mentioned.
Tell us what are you in plain English for other people. What does Reference USA do?
So Reference USA gives you tons and tons and tons of information about companies. So they'll tell you what they sell, how much of it they sell, who their upper level offices are. It'll give you some idea of other subsidiary businesses, so you can see who owns what through Reference
USA.
And
of course, you can do it by geography, so you can mm-hmm. find local companies because you're not wanting to commute down to Silicon Valley in these crazy where there's freeway gridlock all the
yes,
time.
Yes, absolutely. They also, if you are going to be, if you're looking to sell stuff, do have some amount of consumer data that you can mine to come up with people to try to sell your stuff to. They have some job listings, some national job listings. They partner with another organization, so I don't know how strong those are. But really the strength of that is in the businesses and then to a lesser extent the consumer information that's
available.
Tell us
about one other. If someone put a gun to your head and said, what is your very favorite career resource, online database for job seekers or career-minded people, what would it be?
I really love Learning Express, which is a primarily targeted at students, but they have a really rich career center, which includes a whole bunch of career information for folks who are doing career exploration. But they also have practice exams. And I know that a lot of people who are looking at civil service jobs
right.
or considering going back to school but
right.
don't want to pay, hundreds and hundreds of dollars to take some course, this is a way to take those practice tests on your own at home for free so you can see what it is that you're looking for. And I did want to talk about one that's free, but is also available through the library. And this is a Department of Labor website. It's called Career One Stop.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's wonderful in terms of career exploration, but also providing links to training programs and some job search info.
Self-assessment, videos,
yeah.
everything, where you get to, right, you say where you get trained. So
yeah.
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what I think we'll do? I think we want to go to the phones.
Okay.
Dear listeners, I'm Marty Nemko, and I'm talking with Sarah Denton. She's the acting deputy director for the Berkeley Public Library about what it's like to be a librarian. If you have a question for her about the field of librarians or even any how to better use the library for your career-related issue, I invite you to call. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You told me something that I didn't know, that the Berkeley Public Library, and I imagine others, I'm sure Berkeley doesn't have a monopoly on this,
mm-hmm.
but offers a service that gets people free feedback on their resume online as well as in person. Tell me about that.
Okay, it's actually two different programs.
Okay.
The first is we do hold resume workshops fairly regularly, so unfortunately I don't have access to my calendar that would tell me when the next one is. But if you check our calendar, that's berkeleypubliclibrary.org is our website.
Berkeleypubliclibrary.org.
Yeah. So if you check on our calendar, we do have a number of workshops that we hold regularly for job seekers as well as for small business folks. And so check the calendar for those resume workshops. But one of the services that we subscribe to is called tutor.com. And again, that's geared primarily towards students, but one of the services they offer is a resume review service. So you upload your resume to the database, and someone who is a career counselor takes a look at that, makes notes on it, and sends it back to you. And I've actually used it. I think they're very good. They've got a really good eye. And it's really easy, and it's totally free.
Tom, you mentioned in passing that was only one of the things at Tutor.com. What are some other things that an adult might use Tutor.com for?
Tutor.com does include tutoring for courses all the way up through high school. So if you're doing GED stuff, they can provide some support around the math and writing portions of that. They do have some practice tests, but their real strength is that when you're working with a tutor, you're working with a real person. When you send your resume out into the world, a real person is looking at it. It's not just a machine or a video.
Wonderful. Let's project forward.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you see libraries evolving in the coming years.
One of the things that we're seeing in large library systems is a move from just containing content that other people have made to creating space for people to make content. A lot of this is about the makerspaces that many people have heard of. You know, 3D printers were very hot. Laser cutters for acrylic jewelry, that's what I wish we had. I would play with that. But more than that, there are other kinds of content that the library is helping people create. So some places have music recording studios.
Wow.
Or places where you can record a podcast.
Wow.
And other places have actual publishing machines. So for a very low cost, you can take your thumb drive with your novel on it, take it to the library, work with somebody to kind of set it up a little bit, and then they'll print you 10 copies of your novel for a very low price.
True self-publishing.
Yeah.
You said it was Sacramento.
Sacramento is the one that I'm most familiar with, but I know that there are others in the area as well.
And what if you personally,
mm-hmm.
if you were to, let's say, I know you just got this promotion, acting deputy director, which mm-hmm. is awesome, but let's say you were the czarina of libraries
mm-hmm.
for the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the one change you would make in libraries moving forward?
Oh, there are lots that I would make, but I think the focus on one of the things that's most important to me about libraries is the fact that we are a place where the community can come together, regardless of who you are, regardless of where you're from. And we do it through literature, but I would like to see us all have spaces where we can create conversations and interactive programming, whether that's arts or book groups or discussion forums or, you know, salons about particular issues. But I think having that space where people can come and be together, regardless of how much money you make or what you look like, there are so few of those left. And that is just vital as part of something that we do, as far as I'm concerned.
And my last question, you know, because I am a career counselor, and
mm-hmm.
I view you not just a guest as a resource, as mm-hmm. though you were a library book off the shelf or a database. What if there was one question you would ask me
mm-hmm.
about your career where maybe we could spend the last couple of minutes my offering some, maybe trying to be helpful to you as
mm-hmm.
you have this new job?
Mm-hmm.
What would be the one question you'd want to spend a couple of minutes kicking around with me right now?
I think the biggest question for me is how you manage moving from peer to supervisor and how you help other people, because I supervise a lot of people and I supervise more people now, how you help them move from peer to supervisor. I think that's a real challenge.
So, you know, I it's always helpful to empower the person. So let's say Marty Nemko vaporized. He
mm-hmm.
doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to role play again. Let's make believe you and I used to be peers.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're my boss.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say that would allow you to both keep the good relationship and at the same time recognize that you now have supervisorial responsibility? Do you know?
Well, I think I'd probably say something like, you know, this is kind of a shift in our relationship, but I know that you're really good at what you do. And so I'm not going to tell you what to do. I want us to work together so that you can keep doing the great stuff that you're doing and I can do what I can to help you continue to do that.
And does your intuition tell you that with the kind of person you're thinking about who used to be a peer, would that work for her, Mara?
I think for this particular person, the sort of imaginary person I have, yeah, it absolutely would.
Okay. And now let's say, you know, you're promoted and you've got you're this big person and you've got a whole lot of new people. Let's say it was your first day of talking to your staff. What would be the wisest thing that you could say to kick things off right?
I think I'd want to say, you know, why don't you tell me what it is that you do and what you like about what you do and what makes it hard for you to do what you do?
Sounds great. And on that note, I don't need to give you any advice. Sarah, I wish you all the best in your new job. And thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Netto.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. And now, dear listeners, we're going to turn. You know, I have been a little remiss. In my effort to make sure that I was left plenty of time in the show to do workovers on callers, I have ignored some of the big picture issues. But something happened this week that made me say, you know what, I've got to look at the big picture. Once again, the government continues to report ha-ha news about the employment situation. The employment rate is down to, unemployment is down to 5%. And so I did some internet research, and I was thinking about should I find a guest, whatever, and I came across this article written by a very eminent person, a guy who held an academic appointment at Stanford. He's testified before Congress 30 times. He wrote a short essay filled with facts that go beyond that statistic. And I thought I would read that to you rather than opine myself, but simply read it to you unedited and then invite you to call to lend your perspective, to amplify, to agree, to disagree. It's called U.S. On the Road to Third World by Paul Craig Roberts. In September, the U.S. Bureau of the Census released its report on U.S. household income by quintile. Every quintile, that's the top 20%, so the second 20%, third, fourth, and fifth. Every quintile, as well as the top 5%, has experienced a decline in real household income since their peaks in 99. The Census Bureau uses official measures of inflation to arrive at, quote, real income. These measures are understated. If more accurate measures of inflation are used, such as those available from shadowstats.com, the declines in real household income are larger. Note that these declines have occurred during an alleged six-year economic recovery from 2009 to the current time, and during a period when the labor force was shrinking due to a sustained decline in the labor market, labor force participation rate, which should increase salaries because of less supply of people. On April 3rd, 2015, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics announced that 93,175,000 Americans of working age are not in the workforce, a historical record. Normally, an economic recovery is marked by a rise in the labor force participation rate. Economist John Williams reports that when discouraged workers are included among the measures of the unemployed, the U.S. unemployment rate is currently 23%, not the 5% reported figure. And I'm going to parenthetically make a statement here. Don't you, when you really know the human beings who you know, friends, family, colleagues, are most people, unless they're like tech superstars, are their careers booming or are ever more people working part-time, temp, for crap wages? I'm continuing to read. In a recently released report, the Social Security Administration provides annual income data on an individual basis. Are you ready for this? He wrote that, not me. In 2014, 38% of all American workers made less than $20,000. 51% made less than $30,000. 63% made less than $40,000. And 72% made less than $50,000. And now I'm making a parenthetical. To broad brush say the unemployment rate is down to 5.0 completely obliterates these more human realities. I'm continuing to read. When half of 25-year-olds... I skipped a paragraph. The largely part-time jobs that are the ones getting created do not provide enough income to form a household. Consequently, as a Federal Reserve study reports, quote, nationally, nearly half of 25-year-olds lived with their parents in 2012 and 13, up from just over 25% in 1999, doubling the number of under 25-year-olds living with their parents. Continuing to read. When half of 25-year-olds cannot form households, the market for houses and home furnishings collapses. Finance is the only sector in the U.S. economy that is growing. The financial industry's share of GDP has risen from less than 4% in 1960 to about 8%, double that today. As Michael Hudson has shown, finance is not a productive activity. It is, quote, a looting activity. The absence of growth in real consumer income means that there is no growth in aggregate demand to drive the economy. Consumer indebtedness limits the ability of consumers to expand their spending with credit. These spending limits on consumers means that new investment has limited appeal to businesses. The economy simply cannot go anywhere except down as businesses continue to lower their costs by substituting part-time jobs for full-time jobs and by substituting foreign for domestic workers. Government at every level is over-indebted and, quote, quantitative easing has oversupplied the U.S. currency. This is not the end of the story. When manufacturing jobs depart, research, development, design, and innovation follow. An economy that doesn't make things does not innovate. The entire economy is lost, not merely the supply chains. The economic and social infrastructure is collapsing, including the family itself, the rule of law, and the accountability of government. When college graduates can't find employment because their jobs have been offshored or given to foreigners on work visas, the demand for college education declines. To become indebted only to find employment that cannot service student loans because of a bad economic decision. We already have the situation where college and university administrations spend 75% of the university's budget on themselves, hiring adjuncts to teach the classes for a few thousand dollars. The demand for full-time faculty with a career before them has collapsed. When the consequences of putting short-term corporate profits before jobs for Americans fully hit, the demand for university education will collapse, and with it, American science and technology. It is a reasonable conclusion that a social, political, economic system so incompetently run already is a third-world country. Anyway, that is the essay, the article written by Paul Craig Roberts, who, as I said, held an academic appointment at Stanford, testified before Congress 30 times. And I think it's wiser, rather than me adding my voice, I've been talking plenty just simply in reading his, I invite you to respond, to agree, disagree, tell, amplify, tell your human story about whether the economy has been growing for you, or do you think that 5% unemployment rate that is so widely and universally trumpeted by the mainstream media is accurate. All perspectives, respect, as long as it's respectfully dispensed, are welcome. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And to the phones, it is now your turn on the air. What is on your mind?
Hey, is it me?
It is.
Well, I have to say that article seems right on, and it's totally applicable to my situation in the job market. And most of my friends and my coworkers, for example, I'm working somewhere now. I have a master's degree, and I'm working for minimum wage, about 13 hours a week, in a really physically demanding retail job locally. Mm. And all of our, a lot of our hours were just cut because the employers were told that if we work 20 hours or more, they have to give us benefits, and they do not want to, so we have had our hours cut. And I have other friends in similar positions, and it's pretty difficult out there, and I'm not self-supporting, and myself and a lot of people I know are on government assistance of one sort or another, be it Section 8, food stamps. Actually, coworkers have been telling each other to apply for food stamps because that's basically how they eat. And I don't know. It's really discouraging out there. So all we can do is remain hopeful and hope that things may improve. But I'm hoping you post that article on your website because I would like to forward it to friends and family.
I promise to do that, but I always like, you know, just because the overall situation societally may be dire in the way we're going, doesn't mean that I can't be a potentially some help to you. So would you like me to try to help you find something that might be better off than a draining retail job at $13 an hour?
Oh my goodness, I'm making 11. I live in Berkeley, and Berkeley minimum wage was 10. It just went up to 11, and actually our employers are contracted out by a company based in Kansas, and they were trying to not even have us paid the Berkeley minimum wage.
Wow.
Justifying it by saying, well, our company, home company, is based in Kansas.
Jesus.
Yes.
So would you like...
That's the city of Berkeley, you know.
Yeah.
City of free speech, and you name it, and it's pretty surprising.
So would you like me to try to help you find something better?
Sure, that would be wonderful.
So tell me
Let's
a couple of clues about you. What was the master's degree you got in?
Pardon?
What's your master's degree in?
My master's degree is from UC Berkeley. Master's degree from a program called, if I say it, people will know possibly who I am, but it's designed through a small program that was through School of Architecture, Center for Environmental Design, and I have to say it was more like independent study, and my fellow cohort and I, neither of us are gainfully employed. Another one who started a year after us in the same program ended up moving back home to live with his mom at age of 40-something.
Mm-hmm. Just think about it. That's UC Berkeley. Could you imagine? There were 3,000 colleges in the United States. From Laney College to Southwestern Oklahoma Baptist College, and you're at UC Berkeley, the world's most prestigious public university, with a master's degree, and you're making $11 an hour in a job where they're not even wanting to pay you the local minimum wage?
Yeah, it's surprising, isn't it? And I'm, as you can imagine, have a lot of student debt. I was actually a transfer student from Southern California, so my first 2 years I had no student loan debt, but transferring to finish my BA here at UC Berkeley incurred student loan debt, and also for my master's degree. And I thought I would graduate and have some amazing job, pay off my student loan in no time. When the economy crashed in 2008, that just seems to have exacerbated whatever was going on with the job situation and outsourcing, and
That's why that's why this show and, you know, public radio, or just in general, to try to add nuance to it. Seems so outrageous to me that the media, all of it, you know, PBS, NBC, CNN, they just parrot this stupid 5% statistic. What I'm hearing,
they don't understand it.
They don't want to report it. But anyway, let's go back to you. So you've got kind of a set of environmental design interest. Is that? Tell me more about your own expertise and interest.
Well, I'll just say I've been supporting myself since I was. I have a lot of skills. I run the gamut of left brain, right brain.
Tell me more.
Oops, my phone's about to die. Let me plug it in. I also have a finance accounting background. I've done that, bookkeeping. I've done a lot of theater work, actually, theater production.
Mm-hmm. Theater production, what aspect of that? What did you do? What do you do?
Oh, I loved it. When I lived in the Los Angeles area, I was actually worked at a theater complex there. I did assistant director, props manager, assistant to the director, stuff and some sound work.
Okay.
You know, run the light board when just to fill in when people didn't show
sure.
up. And since moving here, I did a took a set design class, but also have worked as a house manager on some productions locally and in San Francisco. Just you know how that is. It's you know short run, and I do it during the run, and it's nonprofit, so you get paid minimally. But
exactly. So
yeah, it was great.
So I'm just curious. You know, you've got this design interest and background. You have the theater background. I'll put aside the finance for a moment. It'll be. It's
sure.
kind of a cheesy, cheap, easy thing to say. You're probably better off learning how to be a bookkeeper or entry level accountant than working that retail job.
I did that for most of my life. I sort of fell into that. I took a typing class, and from there, started as a secretary receptionist for some accountants. They started teaching me bookkeeping. Worked my way up to doing taxes, doing financial statements. I had clients that were like a $13 million client. But throughout that, I was also, I would do that during the day and then have my other interests
right.
that I also did, such as the theater or the arts or music.
Right.
And yeah, when I decided to go back to school, I decided to do the dream that I had had since I was, you know, a child of the arts thing. And also I dropped out of high school, but was doing the accounting thing, no problem, making great money. And it's ironic that when I finally went back and finished my AA, my BA, and then got accepted to UC Berkeley, is when I was no longer able to be gainfully employed.
That's the reality, because everybody loves the arts. Everybody likes creative expression, and supply and demand means it's just hard to make a living doing it. Let me try to propose something. You know,
sure.
I do think it's kind of a machine, especially since you're saying the retail job is not only paying $11 an hour, but it's, you say, physically draining. It seems like you got to get your butt...
Yeah, because I'm you know, a middle-aged kind of person. I do not seem it, but yeah, it's just physically, it's very
sure.
draining. But I do actually enjoy working with the people, helping the customers. I mean, that's really joyful when I go there. I just, to see someone smile and make them happy, it just, or even if someone's in a bad mood and by the time they leave, they've got a smile on their face because at least you've listened to them. I mean, people have told me, maybe I'd be a good therapist or something, but I really do enjoy that.
What I'm saying, I need to make you self-supporting more likely.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether the smart route would be trying to utilize that theater experience that you said you love, but in a practical way that isn't so overcrowded. You know, we still live in an era where trade shows and conventions and conferences are all over the place, millions of them. And every one of the booths at these major conferences, whether it be a international car show or a technology thing or a environmental fair or whatever, they, especially the major corporations, have these very fancy exhibit areas, and they use people to set those up. Given your background, I'm wondering whether you might tie that experience as an assistant director down in Hollywood-ish to do that kind of work for setting up exhibits at conventions, trade shows, and the like. What do you think?
Oh, that sounds great.
Okay. So where I would start, it would be, you know, Moscone Center is an epicenter in the Bay Area for that kind of thing. And I would go and I would go to the website for Moscone Center and find somebody who's in charge of the logistics, the setting up of these events, and say your truth. Tell about what you did in Southern California. Say that you're now stuck in some retail job. While it feels good, it's paying you $11 an hour. You have design interest, but you're also not ignorant of financial concerns. So you're not some flighty, just artist who has no money background. In fact, you've been doing some high-level accounting. And ask, where does that person see as a logical place for you to turn to create a launch pad for a career in setting up wonderful exhibits, maybe, and there are entertaining exhibits at these trade shows and the like. What do you think?
Oh, that sounds wonderful, because I've actually done curation of things like Day of the Dead show, things like that in the city, and I really enjoy that, or working with the curator. So
awesome. We don't, you know, it hurts my soul to hear you, a person who has worked hard to get a master's degree from Berkeley, working for $11 an hour and some smiles from satisfied customers. I think you need to, you know, I love smiles too, but I think you need to be self-sufficient, and I hope that helps.
It does, thank you, because my self-esteem, and it's hard to keep that up when you are not self-sufficient and self-reliant. I have been my whole life, and it's just,
right.
it really does affect a lot of different areas of life, really.
I understand. You know, of course, your self-esteem should depend not just on your income, but, you know, this is really cliched, but if you are a kind person and a good person, that is critical and contributory. That should be maybe the most important part of your self-esteem, not how many dollars you've earned on your paycheck.
Yeah, I am what you just mentioned, but so far that hasn't helped me get gainfully employed.
I know. Well, that's why we focus on getting you gainfully employed.
Yeah, thank you so much, Marty. I really appreciate your ideas and your support. Thank you.
And I loved your candor. I appreciated your call very much.
Oh, thank
you. Hey, feel free to call. Please, you know, I love truth. So call back when you've played it out. And
okay.
Let us know whether it worked, it didn't work, partly worked. Just say your truth, and that's all I need to hear.
Oh, thank you, Marty. I appreciate it.
Okay, you take care and be well.
You too. Thank
you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am. I had read this very powerful essay that really dug beneath the soundbite of the 5% unemployment rate to describe the real reality, and inviting you, my dear listeners, to call in and react. I deliberately did not opine myself. Because, you know, you've just heard my voice too much. So, but again, if you, I'm not going to read it again, obviously, but if you heard it and would like to opine, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. Thank you so much for your patience. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome.
I've listened to your show for a long time.
Right.
I'm always interested in the way in which people's ideas, including my own and your own, evolve.
Yeah.
Hopefully we all evolve in our thinking.
Right.
In the past, in discussing unemployment, I've had the sense that you have attributed to I would say, an inordinate extent, but that's just my opinion, problems with U.S. wages being significantly due to government regulations, sexual harassment, lawsuit costs, and a set of things, maternity leave, a set of things like that. And I get a sense in your voice, at any rate, and again, maybe I'm misperceiving it, that your perceptions about the causes of the problem and the severity of the problems associated with what the essay described have evolved. And I know you said you didn't want to comment, but I would very much appreciate you saying something about the ways in which your ideas about the causes of these problems have or have not changed over the recent years.
You called with that exact question a few weeks ago, but I'll give hopefully a more even more thorough answer. I think I have become, while the cost of hiring an American being so high with paid family leave, Obamacare, regulations, wrongful termination suits, certainly when we increase the cost of hiring an American so much relative to what it takes to hire somebody in a global economy, of course that's a factor that is driving down wages. And immigration, nobody could argue that an increased supply of labor from uncontrolled immigration is going to also increase supply of labor and therefore lower salaries. But there's also where I have evolved. I have become more and more concerned, skeptical about capitalism's ability to provide well enough to enough of its people. In the last year, I had a number of guests were talking about, you know, what do we do in this information economy where to really make a good living, it requires these very high-level intellectual skills. And then just the reality is, too small. It doesn't require a very large number of them to create cool software or cybersecurity or whatever. There's millions and millions, 340 million people in the United States, and it takes only a small fraction of them to create, for example, that piece of software and no people to manufacture it. Unlike in the previous era, you can just push a button and you get millions of copies of the software.
Right.
So some of where the evolution has occurred is I don't think capitalism works moving forward. I think there is going to be a need for, A, everybody to have to recognize that we are going to live on less and that materialism is not going to be the answer, and that we do need to provide a solid safety net for health care and food and shelter and education, because it's just there just aren't going to be enough people to be able to make it in the free market on that free market wages. So that's where I've added my concerns about capitalism and materialism to the equation. Not that the other factors are not significant still.
Marty, I appreciate that very much. Just to my previous question the other time wasn't about that. It was you had given you had been discussing people who go into a new career and kick over the traces, and they say to their family, "Oh, you know, we're going to be on a tight budget and everything, but I really want to go into this new career." And then I had asked you whether you knew of any examples to give some examples in your own experience of your career counseling where that had been true, and you were not, at least at that time, able to identify any easily. So that's a sort of a related question, but I didn't ask the same question.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree, because it may not have been your last call, but I know you asked that question at some point. Doesn't matter, but I really appreciate it's an important question, and I love questions in general. And so, again, as always, I thank you for your continued loyal listenership and your thoughtful questions.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, if you want to. Now, let me broaden this. You know, as always, I care a lot about helping you with your problems. I did with the caller just before this caller. If you are indeed struggling in your work life, whether it be economically struggling, psychically struggling, all are fair game. If you've got a work problem, I do what are called workovers here on KALW on this show, Work with Marty Nemko, and I'd be happy to do it for you. And of course, the price is zero, zippo, nada. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for a workover, I promise not to pummel you, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you're unemployed or a CEO of a big nonprofit or a government agency or a company, I usually can at least help you take a baby step forward. The phone number here on the show is, and we'll probably be able to get you on the phone, maybe, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I mean not on the phone, but on the air. So let's go to the phones, though. We do have calls, so welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Would that be me?
It is.
Ah, well, thank you, Mr. Nemko. I want to say, when you said that you were going to read that article, I thought, oh, boy. You know, here we go. But I want to thank you for doing that. It was very, very clearly and well communicated article.
Thank you.
And I just want to make a couple comments on that and then ask you, and then turn it to a personal interest that you might be able to help me with.
Mm-hmm.
The article seemed to articulate something about the way we seem in this country to be living in a dream that our economic system is actually sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Just to say that it's not, but we're presenting it as if it is, or we're living as if it is, and I think that ties into something in the current zeitgeist that's been so mysterious for people that I've talked to about it, which is how is it that the whole Republican Party, you know, nationwide, all they can do is put up basically people who are out of touch with reality to be their front runners in a presidential election, to be in line, to try to be in line to have that much authority and be so out of touch with reality. And I think it these two things correlate in a rather scary way.
Let me comment on those first before you go on to something else. I think we generally, you know, it's hard to go through life as a pessimist or you want to commit suicide. So, you know, the young people today, even though they're seeing how many people are living, young people living back with their homes, they continue to profess great idealism about their future. We all tend to want to, you know, we think we're going to live forever. So there's that. With regard to the Republicans, I am also deeply dismayed, and I am a moderate. I almost always do vote Democrat. I'm usually kind of a more, you know, more one of the conservative Democrats. But I am really dispirited by the, I think out of touchness is fair to say, you know, the Donald Trumps or the Ben Carsons who are at the top of the heap. I have much more positive feelings toward Marco Rubio, though he's anti-choice, which is repulsive to me personally. But yes, they feel very out of touch. And I think that, on the other hand, I think that people like Hillary, and I'm going to be fair here, people like Hillary and Bernie Sanders are unaware of the huge cost to society that would happen from all the redistribution they want. I listen to all that they want to offer, and there isn't enough. If we tax the rich at 100%, there isn't enough money to pay for what they want, and that's going to just ultimately, all that redistribution will help people in the short term, the poor people, but will it really lift people permanently into sustainable employment, a better economy? I think both parties are equally simplistic and not willing to be candid because of the horrible system in which why we elect people, where it's who wins the debate, who says the more nice things, who promises more nice things to people. So I think the real problem, yes, the real problem is that to be electable, you have to be a BSer, in my judgment, and not willing to be honest.
Well, you know, that's a good segue to my second comment.
Okay.
Which is that the things you just said, both parties being out of touch, is because they're not paying attention to the fundamentals. And I think that the fundamental element brought out in that article is a good starting point,
yep.
which is the emphasis on short-term profit.
Yep.
Okay, and that is what, you know, you can look at so many problems that we have, and you can list, you know, you can make quite a list. And the emphasis on short-term profit really covers, would be an umbrella that would cover many of them. But, and I again, just to tie back to your point about optimism being a good thing, I agree, but it needs to have a sound basis, or else
you know what? I want to, and I don't want to get off too much too politically here. You know, I'm concerned though.
Let me just focus on the question. To me, then, is who's going to articulate the actual alternative to the focus on short-term profit?
I'm not sure. I can't necessarily accept you're painting it, giving an awful broad umbrella to the short-term profit thing. That's my concern about capitalism, because in general, for a company to survive, if I am a president of a company and I'm thinking about the importance of workers and I'm going to make sure they're paid very well, even though my competitors are paying crap, I'm going to be out of business. It was like, I like to talk about that Owings Mill company that promised we will not have any layoffs, we will make sure everybody's full-time, everybody's got benefits, etc., and they were out of business in 2 years because none of their competitors did. So the problem is not the individual company's focus on short-term profits. I think it's capitalism's inability to provide sustainable employment for a lot of people. We've got all the lines lit up, so I want to take as many perspectives as I can. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Is this me?
It is.
All right. Yeah, so I was really interested with your previous comment. I about the, like, when we can just, you know, print, like, we can just make, you know, millions of things, how are we going to employ all the people?
Right.
So I happen to run a 3D printing store over at the Great Mall and over in Milpitas.
Yep.
And it's kind of interesting. You know, it's this huge, I'm not sure if you know the history of that mall, but it used to be this huge automotive factory.
No, I didn't. Oh, I didn't know that.
And, you know, it's, you know, gigantic thing, used to employ so many people, but now, you know, I'm running this little thing that can, you know, just make pretty much any object people want, and it's like taking away from that whole need for the gigantic factory and bringing it back. I'm wondering what your comments are on, like, you know, how does our political system, how does our economic system evolve when it's not only you can, you know, make millions of copies of the software, but you can also make millions of copies of objects.
I think that's going to kill jobs. 3D, you know, and I also, you know, at least at this point, you're in the vanguard. Hopefully you're not on the bleeding edge, you're on the cutting edge. But every little 3D printed object I've seen tends to be kind of, you know, kitschy and like a little toy. And I worry that, you know, they often say that in business you can't be too early and you can't be too late. If you're trying to make money, I'm not convinced that the maker space, you know, 3D printing is there yet, except in the medical, maybe in medical devices or something. But I also worry that, in fact, that's going to, you know, of course, every automation is going to reduce jobs. And, you know, anybody, you know, my wife and I visited the Olive Garden. They have a waiter for part of the time, but you can do your ordering, you can do your tipping. Everything is, you know, on this little iPad that's on your table. You know, every time we automate, it's killing more jobs. And I can't help but think that 3D printing, as it gets more sophisticated, is going to kill more jobs.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, most people, like, they think of it as kind of like the chit-chat thing, but, like, it's interesting because, you know, I actually just moved the company here from Vermont, and my first store was right across from Bernie Sanders' office. Like, I've met Bernie a few times. He definitely gets this, but I think that it's moving a little bit quicker than you realize. I mean, most of my jobs are replacement parts for people. Like, but it's really interesting because, like, the politicians, yeah, they I love them to death. You know, well, I love some of them to death.
That makes one of us.
They kind of don't understand just how quickly the ground is shifting underneath them.
How is it, give me, well, tell me, how is it, how, where, what should I know as a career counselor and listeners to a career-related show? What should we understand about how the 3D printing world is changing the world of employment?
Well, I'd say it's more, it's coming along the lines of where, you know, you're not building things, but you can design things. You know, I have a ton of people who come in and say, all right, I've come up with a great new idea for a product. I need to pitch to investors. You know, I can't afford a, you know, mold for it. So can you help me? So
I see.
I think that it's not going to really, like, replace all the jobs that it's kind of taking away from traditional manufacturing. But it will allow people of all walks of life to be able to, you know, rapidly invent things.
Yep.
So I think that that more entrepreneurial, like, go out and invent something new, that kind of, that I think it'll throw fuel on that fire.
Fair enough. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello?
Hello? Oh, is it? Oh.
Would you turn down your phone, please? Your radio?
Sure.
Great.
I was thinking about the previous caller, and it also really hurt my soul as well, hearing this woman who worked very hard for a master's degree was earning $11 an hour, and I wanted to put out a resource and get your critique of some of these things like TaskRabbit and Odesk. And,
oh, my God, yes, right.
Yeah, what, you know, because, I mean, I'm going for a career change, a rather risky one. And, you know, I'm making about $30 an hour doing random assignments.
Doing what? I didn't hear you. You cut out. You doing what?
For a TaskRabbit. So, I mean, I do
everything
from bookkeeping, event staffing, moving help. You know, I'll charge like $45 an hour to help people pack up for a move. You know, and then TaskRabbit takes 30% off the first time that you do a job for somebody. Once they become a repeat client, only 15%. So, I mean, you know, I definitely, like, you don't have any health care or job security with TaskRabbit.
Like Uber, you know.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, it's quite problematic. But at the same time, you know, being able to make $30 an hour and always be able to meet my clients and go to any kind of workshop I want, for the business that I'm starting is incredibly empowering. So I'd just like to hear some of your feedback on those various economies.
Yes. I mean, if you're making $30 an hour doing what you want with a lot of flexibility, there's some advantage to that. I worry as that ever more good jobs go away and ever more people are doing this, the ever greater supply is going to mean that people will be competing ever harder for doing, well, I'll do it for $20 an hour and I'll do it for $15 an hour. And I've seen this on Odesk, which is the problem. Now it's called Upwork. Odesk merged with Elance to become Upwork. And the jobs are, you know, the competition, they're like, I was looking for a transcriber to transcribe these radio shows. And it was like, I could get somebody for $8 an hour. $5 an hour in India for deadly sedentary work, because now everybody's competing with people all over. I ended up hiring somebody in Hungary, and then there was somebody in Bangladesh, and there was someone who wanted to do it for $3.32 an hour. So I just worry that such a transparent marketplace is fantastic for people who want to hire, but I worry that it's, you know, that in the end it's a race to the bottom for the worker. That's my honest answer. I'm glad you're making 30. I hope you keep it, but I can't be optimistic that, you know, as more people are not getting or losing those big, cool, benefited jobs and they're going to turn to work at TaskRabbit, that can't help but drive salaries down. That's my honest opinion. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. I really want to thank all of you for calling Work with Marty Nemco and your opinions. Again, as always, intelligent agreements, disagreement, respectful. Again, this is what I think public radio should be. A certain amount of helping you as an individual, but also looking at societally, how can we really look, go beyond what the mainstream media says to really trying to foundationally improve the world of work. And my thanks, of course, to my board operator, Joanne Marr, as well. Please join me again next Sunday. It'll be a much more fun show, I promise. I'm going to, you know, in this my semi-regular feature called What's It Really Like to Be, I'm doing What's It Really Like to Be a Piano Bar Entertainer. I'm going to talk with Jeff Labus, who does it weekly at Marin Joe's, and he's going to do a demo for us on how he's a piano bar entertainer, and he's probably going to be able to twist my arm into playing a duet with him. I play the piano, too. So until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco, ever striving for balance, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.